Okay, well, I'm going to talk today about events that occurred on the waterfront, predominantly in Perth and Melbourne in 1919. To put it in context, in this excellent book, some of you may have read, it's an oral history of the Melbourne waterfront. I believe it's in this book, though I've tried to find it, and I'm not sure. My memory is of reading in the book. Maybe I just heard it. But there was a quote, famous quote from a Melbourne wharfie, along the line, very elderly Melbourne wharfie, along the lines of, people today don't care about one another anymore. They don't hate scabs like they should. and what I'm going to talk about is when one of the key events when that hatred of scabs was created. Because it's not the case that, you know, when you walk into Port Melbourne, something in the air suddenly makes you left wing. Obviously, traditions, union traditions, militancy, all has to be created. And the key, I think the key, really the key event in the traditions of the Melbourne waterfront in particular is not, as is often assumed, the 1928 strike, but the earlier strike in 1917. And what I'm talking about today is the aftermath of that strike, because the great strike which swept through the eastern states of Australia in 1917 was defeated by mass scabbing. And where that scabbing impacted the most was on the waterfront, because on the waterfront, while it's not true that being a wharfie was unskilled work, there was a lot of skill involved. Nevertheless, it's something that you could sort of do if you had never worked on a waterfront before. So it was easier to employ scabs there than in a lot of other places. And it was obviously of key strategic significance in breaking the strike. At the end of the 1917 strike, there was in Sydney and Melbourne something like 1,000 scabs who remained. There'd been up to 2,000 working in each of the ports during the course of the strike. Many of them, of course, were middle-class university students in particular. They, of course, didn't want to stay, but there were about 1,000 who did. The industrial situation was made worse. It wasn't just that there were scabs there, but you have to understand the nature of working on the waterfront in this period meant that it was what we call today casual on call. Not over the phone, obviously. You went down and you got picked like this at a call-up. The union had won something called preference, which meant that, that while it's up to the foreman to choose whoever he likes, he had to at least choose a union member. And it was only when all the union members in the hall were picked that he could pick someone else. This was lost in the 1917 strike. And in order to reward the scabs to ensure that they would be picked first, they created their own union, scab union, which was registered with the Arbitration Commission and was given preference. So the new situation on the waterfront in Sydney and Melbourne was that scabs would be picked, and only when all the scabs had got work would ordinary wharfies, union members or non-union members, be picked. The other thing to understand is that in 1917, to put this into context, there was another strike over a separate issue in Perth at the same time. And while it wasn't a part of the Great Strike, the Conservative government in Western Australia borrowed the tactics used in the eastern states. It created its own scab bureau, it recruited its own volunteers, as they were called, and they also created their own scab union. So you had a similar situation in Fremantle after 1917. Now, all this is all very well for the employing class, but then a bit of a problem happened strategically. That is that the war ended. And with the end of the war, there were two groups of people started to appear on the waterfront looking for work. One group were returned servicemen who had been wharfies before the war, who had been members of the Waterside Workers Federation, and were now back, naturally, looking for their old jobs. The other group were returned servicemen who hadn't been wharfies before the war, but because this is a place where you could get casual work, were also drift down to the waterfront looking for work because they didn't have a job to return to. So, and it's important to distinguish between the two because there's a slightly different dynamic with each, but nevertheless, there is, in all these three ports, large numbers of returned servicemen. Now, you have to, it doesn't really take a great deal of imagination to imagine what this meant for someone who'd just been through the horrors of the Western Front, who'd volunteered for King Country, been a, you know, done what they're supposed to and endured all of that, come home and find someone who not only was a scab, but a scab who hadn't bothered to fight in the war in front of you. And someone who had just been involved in pushing back the Prussian army successfully on the Western Front, there's a fairly obvious solution to the problem. And that really sets up for what occurred in 1919. Now, the actual historical record of what happened is very, very confusing if you look at the histories of the waterfront. I think this is a non-academic audience. I can say they're complete crap. And they contradict each other. Margot Beasley, in her book The Wharfies, says that the SCAD Labour Bureau in Melbourne was abolished by a nice man called Justice Higgins, who everyone knows is a nice man, in August 1919. Rupert Lockwood has the Wharfies defeated, and he doesn't say what they were defeated in, because he doesn't say they were on strike, but they were defeated, and in December 1919, several months after Beasley has the Bureau being abolished, going to register at the Bureau. Well, needless to say, they're both completely wrong, and I'll explain what happened. It all starts, well, really started straight away, December 1917, even before the soldiers arrived. Now, it's important, during the actual 1917 strike, or at least in the early stage of the 1917 strike, the Wharfies did not confront the scabs. They did not use violence. They were determined to be respectable. This is important to understand that the militancy, the hatred of the scabs, it had to be won. It wasn't automatic. It was only when the strike was defeated, clearly defeated, and they were locked out, and particularly in an incident in Melbourne in October after 2 months of strike, where the Wharfies were encouraged by Higgins to just go down, see if they'll pick you. And they thought, that means we've got our jobs back, and of course they weren't picked, and then they started fighting the scabs. That was when the first violence occurred in Melbourne. There was some in Sydney earlier, but no, it wasn't automatic. However, by the time they got back to work in December, after 3 months of a strike turned into a lockout, that was all over. And in fact, there was a letter from from the secretary of the SCAB Union complaining to the police commissioner in December 1917, 2 weeks after the end of the strike, complaining that one of his members had been hospitalised and that they were being terrorised by the Wharfies. This was not a full-scale war. It was a sort of a guerrilla war. It was little isolated incidents, though it was sufficient to discourage a number of the scabs. And you can see that it's clear from the point of view of the Wharfies. It's a question of arithmetic. You've got this 1,000 bastards taking your jobs, and you've got to wait till they all get picked before you can get a job. If you can reduce their numbers by any means, if you can intimidate them and get them to go, maybe you should go look for a job in somewhere else. Don't you think? No? Sweet reason. Convince them to go away. Now, in Perth, however, was where it came to a head. Now, this is actually reasonably well documented, but not all of you would be aware of it, so I'll go through what happened in Perth, because it's fun. In May 19... in Perth, the building of alliance between the diggers and the waterfront union was made easier by the fact that the head of the Fremantle union, both called Bill Renton, he was actually a reasonably conservative political figure. He wasn't a great lefty. He had two sons who were diggers and who died within a month of armistice. So he was an obviously someone with whom the diggers could, feel a lot of sympathy with. And there was an alliance quickly formed. In fact, they opened the books of the union to any returned servicemen. And everything came to a head in May this was during the influenza epidemic that took place after the war. It was killing millions of people in the panic. And they were trying to keep Perth isolated because they could. And there was quarantine in place. And the government decided to break quarantine on a ship. And the union refused, and the SCAB union, being SCABs, agreed to unload the ship. And this was an excuse, an obvious propaganda excuse for the Wharfies to go on the offensive. The response of the Premier of West Australia, a bloke by the name of Hal Kolbach, was to accompany the SCABs to Fort Fremantle. Thousands, virtually all of Western Australia's police force was mobilised with bayonets, just to make sure. Barricades are set up, and the Premier, with his little boatload of scabs, sailed down the Swan River, Scrap River, to Fremantle, to ceremonially begin work. The entire population of Fremantle virtually met them. In fact, the St. Patrick's Church, it was a Sunday, St. Patrick's Church, Catholic Church in Fremantle, the priest ordered his congregation to leave Mass and go down and join the picket lines. Now, yes, the police did have bayonets and they charged the crowd and they murdered one Wharfie and they wounded Bill Renton. But it takes more than a copper with a bayonet to defeat people who've sort of tangled with the German army a few months ago. They knew more about bayonet charges and they had armed themselves by various means, including jam tin bombs, which they knew how to make from the trenches, and they drove the police out of Fremantle. So successfully that they won the strike, the government caved in the next day, and the police station in Fremantle was abandoned for several months. Now, as you can imagine, this was greeted with a degree of interest by the Wharfies in Melbourne and elsewhere. And I have a quote here from The Age on the 15th of May 1919. Developments that occurred yesterday indicate the trouble similar to that which happened at Fremantle within the last few weeks is impending. It is said that the Loyalists, most of whom did not don khaki during the war, have been getting preference to the exclusion of returned soldiers who are members of the Wharf Labourers Union. But the best quote, which is also from The Age, but this is from the president of the Melbourne sub-branch of the Returned Sailors and Soldiers Imperial League, that's the ancestor of the RSL, complaining, "An attempt was being made by a certain section of the unionists on the wharves to use the returned soldier as a tool to get rid of the loyalists. He had actively, sick, seen returned soldiers being egged on to attack loyalists on the wharves. One man, wearing a returned soldier's bag, had thrown a loyalist into the river. He had seen others assault several loyalists. The unionists had loudly applauded, but they took care to keep out of the pool themselves." I don't know what he's more upset about, their refusal. Would it have been better if they joined in? I'm not sure. Now, what made... you've got to understand the atmosphere at this time. So a couple of things that are in background. As well as the problem of the scabs, to one simple statistic. The cost of living between 1914 and... collapsed. No, it didn't. The cost of living and between 1914 and late 1919, according to a Royal Commission in 1920, increased by 66% over that five-year period. The Wharfies had been granted an award by Justice Higgins in 1914. They hadn't had a pay rise since. And, you know, these are not wages that are... If they didn't, you know, have lots of extra money that they could give up spending on DVDs and things, you know, this is an earlier period. You can imagine the effect of all of this plus the scabs. That cost of living crisis was affecting another union, the Seamen's Union, which had a new revolutionary leadership, was in the process of getting a new revolutionary leadership by a bloke called Tom Walsh, and a strike was impending by the seamen at this time. There was immense pressure, so much pressure that very conservative union officials in charge of the Waterside Workers' Federation were forced to call a stop work meeting to consider joining in. They managed to put it off, only by saying, well, the seamen haven't gone out yet, we'll have to wait and see if we can have talks with them. They didn't want to have talks with them, but they pretended they were going to have talks with them. And I've read the minutes that they basically went back to their national officials and said, we meant to stop a strike, aren't we good boys, you know, pat us on the head. It was all to no avail. There was never an official alliance between the Wharfies and seamen, but the Melbourne Waterfront went on strike anyway. When the seamen went on strike over wages in the middle of May 1919, this is what happened. Though efforts have been made to cloak the fact, this is The Age, it is evident from what had occurred during the last few days that a state of strike exists as far as the unionist wharf labourers are concerned. On Tuesday, 20th of May, Some of the members of the Wharf Labourers Union were engaged to assist in loading the Grace Darling at number 11 shed in North Wharf. But when the time came for starting work arrived, some of them called upon the Dinkum Unionists to stand aside and they would see the scum of the earth. The Unionists stood aside and the Loyalists, being intimidated, left the vessel. So unofficially, there was a strike. Wharfies were on strike. They were officially on strike, but seamen were on strike anyway, so there wasn't much coming into the port, and to the extent there was anything in the port, no one was unloading. Except occasionally, attempts were made to get scabs to unload ships, and this is what happened to one. On the 23rd of May 17, scabs were working on the steamer Monero at the South Wharf. They were attacked by a group of wharfies who threw coal and coke at them as they worked. The arrival of 20 police restored order, but not for long. It is related that subsequently a crowd of about 400 unionists visited the locality and made overtures to the loyalists. Intermediaries informed them that if they ceased work without delay, they would be given a free passage to their homes. But if they did not take advantage of the offer, no quarter would be shown them. Not surprisingly, the scabs decided to take the free passage home. That same day, a crowd of 1,000 strikers and the women, there's a point made, marched to Trades Hall, where they were addressed by members of the Victorian Socialist Party and so on. A motion was passed calling for the abolition of the Bureau. So even though there's no official strike, and as far as the historians who've done it, that means there was no strike, of course there was. Now, if you remember, there was around 1,000 scabs at the end of the strike in 1917. It will not surprise you, but by this stage, their numbers had diminished somewhat. There were now only 170 scabs left on the Melbourne waterfront. 200. They were in two organisations. One were 170 and the other were 30. But the one with 30 abandoned the waterfront in June. They said, "We cannot return to the wharf for work under the present conditions owing to there being too many men for the work provided," even though there's only 200 of them, "that a large number of the loyalists have never received a living wage." So the point is, that's a fundamental strategic problem for the ruling class when they employ scabs. The point of employing scabs is to cut wages and conditions. But then what's the incentive of being a scab after a while? And here's the problem for scabs, that because, what I just said about the cost of living, they've got this pathetic wage. It doesn't help there's a seamen strike, so there's not much work going on. And then you've got returned servicemen throwing into the river every now and then. This is not really a very attractive proposition. There's also evidence of there's a complaint made, I found in the police archives, to the police about, by the wife of a scab, a group of young children and women had arrived by tram at her, got off the tram near her house and broken the windows and yelled at her and done all sorts of stuff. And the police basically, it's quite clear the police thought, yeah, that's fair enough. and didn't bother to which is actually quite interesting that I found a lot of evidence that the police were pretty much sympathetic. This is, of course, before the police strike purged their ranks of decent policemen in 1923. The next thing, of course, is that the seamen's strike went on. Now, the seamen's strike was successful. It was successful because basically, this was an economy that ran on coal. The coal came from New South Wales. There wasn't any great stockpiles of coal left because they'd used them up, defeating the 1917 strike. And as a result, they were able to starve Victoria of coal, and that was decisively what won their national strike for the seamen. They won in August 1919. The government tried to get Justice Higgins, the supposed workers' friend, to give in to their demands. Higgins refused. He said, no, they've got to go through arbitration. I don't agree with this. The government said, shut up, you idiot. We've got out of coal. And eventually what happened is that Hughes was off in hobnobbing around Versailles at the stage. So the acting prime minister just basically organised a conference and basically by decree gave the seamen everything they wanted, which really, really pissed Higgins off, as you can imagine. Now, remember, as I said, the the Margaret Beasley says that Higgins abolished the Bureau. Well, he didn't. He had nothing to do with it. What happened, of course, was the seamen went back to work in August 1919. The warfare said, no, we're not going back. Why would they surrender that, at least in Melbourne they didn't, why would they surrender that wonderful strategic advantage? Victoria's got no coal. There's no scabs left. No scabs left in the waterfront because the 170 remaining scabs had actually, in early August, approached the Waterside Workers' Federation for help. They wanted the Waterside Workers' Federation to fight to get them compensation in return for leaving the waterfront. One other thing that I've got to mention. During the course of all of this, in the early stages, one of the reasons why the police had difficulty in dealing with the intimidation, there'd been, by the warfies of the scabs, back in 1917, there'd been about 1,000 special constables enrolled and given batons and badges. All these middle-class people were given their little badges and their batons. In 1919, the police commissioner called them up. About 3 of them turned up. And he complained that he didn't have any batons left. So he couldn't enroll anymore. I just couldn't believe it. It was so funny. The government was on a hiding to nothing. The Wharfies, within a week, again, Higgins wouldn't do anything. The government, well, they didn't even bother to approach Higgins, I don't think, in this case. They just went ahead and did the same formula as with the seamen strike. They had a tripartite negotiations, the unions, the employers, the government, not the SCAP union, they ignored them completely. And they came to a decision to abolish the SCAB Labour Bureau and abolish preference for the SCABs and restore it to the Waterside Workers Federation. Stunning victory, which is completely absent from the historical record, which gives you some idea of how bad it is. Okay. However, before we finish, I have to give a few qualifications about this stunning victory. The first is there was a problem in Sydney. The same alliance between the Wharfies and the soldiers didn't go ahead in Sydney. It didn't go ahead because the secretary of the Sydney branch of the Waterside Workers Federation a complete... God, I've forgotten his name for a second. Well, it doesn't matter what his name was. I can look it up later. Take you in discussion. But he was a bit of an idiot. He was an ultra-left, basically. Verbally ultra-left, but industrially quiescent. Which is the worst combination you can have in a union official. He was himself a returned serviceman who returned early, I'm not sure why, and he had actually made a speech in the Domain in early 1919 where he described the returned soldiers on the waterfront as the diarrhea class of soldiers who were sent back early from the war, that they were, and it was believed by the returned servicemen, but I think this is a bit of an urban myth on their part, but he called them 10 bob a day murderers, which is not the way to establish a strategic relationship with a group of new workers in your industry. As a result, they were unable to establish, even though there were marches on the Premier's office in Sydney demanding that he get rid of the scabs by returned servicemen, they couldn't get an alliance going. And also because, the federal office of the of a national executive of the Waterside Federation was bombarding its state branches saying, don't go on strike, don't do anything, because nice Justice Higgins is going to give us a new award with a wage rise, and we can't risk that. And the Sydney branch, with this supposedly revolutionary leadership, was the one that obeyed, whereas the Conservative Fremantle leadership didn't. Which says you something about union officials. Their politics is not necessarily the most important thing. But the important thing about all of this is that Justice Higgins did give a new award to the Waterside Workers' Federation at the end, in late 1919, giving them a 28% pay rise. Remember, the cost of living had increased by 66%. Meanwhile, the Seamen's Union, who got on strike, had got effectively a 66% pay rise. In other words, it's a fairly stark indication of what you should do as a unionist. Don't rely on the courts, take action. And again, it's important it's important we remember what happened in 1919. It's really an interesting parallel to what happened on the waterfront in 1998. In that, the union managed to get rid of the scabs, but they did so at the point of, in this case, of surrendering their wages, because they didn't continue to fight and demand, as the seamen did, a wage rise as well as getting rid of the scabs. In 1998, they got rid of the scabs and they surrendered conditions. Interesting parallels. There's hope. The future of the waterfront from now on is somewhat like the future of the waterfront in the rest of the 20th century after 1917.